Hello everyone, this is Laurette Lynn, the Unplugged Mom, and I am very excited to bring you this first part in a multi-part series, More Trivium. We are going to be joined by longtime thinker, philosopher, observer, and perpetual learner, Gino Denning. He has been exploring the trivium concept for many years. Having been introduced to the trivium at a young age, Gene has had a great deal of experience discovering the meaning and value in this fascinating philosophical concept in human intellectual development. Willing to generously share what he's learned through his knowledge and experience, Gene has appeared in a variety of media venues and has written extensively discussing the trivium concepts, its origins, and practical ways in which we can begin understanding life, living, and our own human experience on a deeper level. I am so proud to present several Unplugged Mom episodes titled More Trivium, in which Gene will help us discover this concept. In this part, an introduction, Gene will help us understand the concept, why it's important, and more interestingly, that we as human beings do actually, very naturally, learn and live in this way. Or at least we're supposed to, by making a conscious effort to explore the ideas and concepts presented here, and then incorporating these into our family lives with our children, so that their natural cognitive abilities to think and reason do not become suppressed. In parts 2, 3, and 4, Gene will help us understand the concept of the trivium, grammar, logic, and rhetoric. These are based on the ancient discovery that human beings naturally develop in this way. And we're going to explore that and understand it a little bit more. Listen up. Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining the Unplugged Mom again. We are going to be reviewing the trivium again. But this time, we're going to be taking a deeper look at the trivium, the concept, what it is, why it's important, and why it truly is the most organic way for the human brain to develop and learn. Now, a lot of you might be shocked to hear me say that a process or a method or something that seems so fabricated and artificial and intellectualized can possibly be a natural and organic way to learn. But if you'll bear with us, I think that you too will understand what I mean when I say that. Now, we've talked about the trivium before on this show. We've spoken to Jan Irving. We've spoken to Jarrett Sanchez. I've talked about it. And by now, most of my listeners know that I'm very, very interested and I'm very, very fascinated. And you know, I want you to understand the reason why it fascinates me so much, because it resonates with me. I feel very comfortable. The more I learn about the trivium, it speaks to me and I understand, and I'm beginning to understand more and more. And I think you will too if you open your mind and really try to absorb this. Now, I think that this is something that's been desperately missing from our culture for so many years. And it's through the deliberate processing and indoctrination of school, and maybe due to a lot of the artificial stimulation that we've had in our culture. But if we can eliminate all that and get past it and truly allow ourselves to learn and explore this concept, I think you too will start to feel like you're more at home intellectually, and you'll start to understand why as it becomes uncovered. Now, I can't consider myself an expert in this field. I consider myself a student and a very open and willing student. So what I have done is found an expert in the field, and Gino Denning, who's joining us today, is going to help us really understand and really go through what the trivium means and why it's important to our culture and why it truly is the natural progression of human understanding and learning. So let's go ahead and meet Gene. Gene, welcome to Unplugged Mom. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm quite honored to have you join us and that you've devoted so much time to helping my audience understand this concept.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for that generous introduction. You referred to me as an expert, but I, like you, simply consider myself a student. And once you understand what the trivium actually is, you'll appreciate your own being as a student. You don't have to be an expert, because what the trivium does is actually reflect the way your your brain works. In fact, learning and practicing using the Trivium will, and I know you made the comment to be cautious of this claim, but it will actually grow the connections within the human brain. And the Trivium itself is an ancient observation, and that's really what it is. It's the Trivium is actually the description of an observation that goes back to primordial times, when people understood that this is the way the human animal relates to its environment, to its world and its universe. And it uses the five senses that we have to communicate with that which is around us.
Najin, before we move forward, I just want to make sure that I clarify. I like the fact that you phrased it that way, and perhaps I was in fact incorrect in using the word expert, because I guess we're all perpetual students, and that really is the point, that we are always learning and always growing. So I like that, and I'd like everybody to really kind of absorb that and really get that this, it's a perpetual learning. We're perpetual students, and we grow and we learn and we allow ourselves to do that. Now, I also want to kind of reiterate specifically for my audience that this is, like you just said, an observation of how human development works. It's not a method that is made up or that is manufactured. And that's why I call it organic, because it's not something that somebody just made artificially and is trying to push on the general population as something that is a brand new concept. This is, it is coming, it is a return home. And I know that we said this in one of our other conversations between you and I, Gene. It's a return home to how the human brain develops and operates and learns. And that's why it's important for us to explore this and recognize it in the same way, so that we can finally break free of whatever paradigm we're stuck in and essentially learn how to learn, if that makes sense.
Well, it makes perfect sense. One of the comments that you just made, though, that is that this is a method that is being pushed on the public. It's exactly the opposite. It seems like within the last several hundred years, as has happened in historical time, it's being hidden from
right. The public. No, I wanted to reiterate that this, I don't want it to come across as a method that is being pushed, mm-hmm. was my point.
Well, it's not an artificial method, artificial, made by the arm of man. It is a discovery, and it's taking implicit knowledge of how our observation begins, how it's put into our, it's stored into our brain, it's brought into an understanding. In other words, all of the contradictions which are within the statement are taken out, and that is understanding. And finally, it's taught. It's taught to other people around us, our children, and in the process, we come to a finer understanding ourselves. But this is an the Trivium is actually an explicit statement of something that we implicitly know. That's why it's like going home when the explanation starts to congeal in the individual's mind. Once it starts to congeal, it's a series of aha moments. And it's almost like, well, I knew this. Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, you do. We all use our five senses if we have normal sensorial operations. We take it into our human brain where we store it. And then as our brain goes through its changes during puberty, we start reaching this idea that we have a conversation within ourselves. And we start taking this data that we picked up in childhood and ongoing through life and bring understanding to it. And we come to an understanding by taking the contradictions, either that are stated within a subject that we're learning, or our own understanding. We apply the critical aspect of the conversation, excuse me, to take the contradictions out. And once we have reached a critical point where we have a critical point of data, and we have taken the critical number of contradictions out of it, we can be said to understand the subject. And then finally, as I say, we communicate this to others, and in the process, the subject becomes finer and finer in our own process of thinking. And in fact, we can start taking possibly that subject and expanding upon it. And this is the way the human store of knowledge and understanding has grown through the ages. But the trivium itself, the word came from medieval times, and it's a Latin word which just means where three roads meet, and it's the first part of the seven liberal arts and sciences. The second part, of course, is called a quadrivium, where four roads meet. But the trivium is really the focus of everything. Before we go on to other subjects, by internalizing the trivium, we actually learn how to learn for ourselves. And the reason that people who've spoken to me could immediately consider me an expert is simply that I was given the various aspects of the trivium through sheer happenstance at the right time in my life. I began my school career essentially by coming to an understanding of what grammar is, which is simply the proper process of absorbing observation or absorbing elementary knowledge. And it's just a discursive, one thing after another, one thing follows from another. And as a child, the two hemispheres of our brain are connected by a cable, let's call it. And it puts the bilateral portions of our brain together to act as a storehouse. Then as we reach puberty, that cable starts to disconnect slightly, and the two hemispheres of the brain start to act a little bit more autonomously, although still connected. But one part of the brain, in effect, asks a question of the other part of the brain, where the data is stored, and either analyzes it, that is, takes it apart, or generalizes, that is, puts it together. And when I get to the description of logic, we'll go into this a little bit more in detail. But as we get into our adolescent or teenage years, we become very adept at utilizing logic. If we know the explicit description of what it is, we just start to use it. We just children and adolescents, children naturally start to use grammar. They naturally start to use the order within general grammar, which I'll describe when we get there. Then after puberty, they just naturally start to use the logical process of their brain. The two halves of their brain start this question and answer, this internal dialogue. And as all of you who have had have remembered your teenage years or have teenagers, you realize that the teenagers become very active, more so than as children, in challenging people. They want to know, and they're very insistent about it. They seem to have very little patience with people when they ask their question. And it's that they're developing this logical sense, particularly in intellectual endeavors. So I think what we should do is start by describing the types of cognition, the types of ways that various stimulus and reaction work in living beings. And I'll describe life as an entity which reproduces itself, provides itself with nutrition, and has respiration. That is, it uses gases within its surroundings to perpetuate itself. And the reason respiration is so important is that it leads to the term called spirit. So a living being is not only the physical being itself, but also the spirit. If you look up the etymology of spirit, it actually means to breathe, to inhale and exhale.
Gene, before we go any further into the, and I'm sorry for interrupting you, but I want to make sure that some points are made here so the audience can follow along with where we're going with this. Before we go too far into the methods of cognition, I want to just kind of solidify what you have been describing and what you've been saying and revert back to the statement that this is an explicit statement basically of something we implicitly know, and the fact that when we study the trivium we discover that this is the natural way that human beings learn. Okay, now my question is, and I'm sort of asking this rhetorically, I'm asking this for the sake of the audience so that you can kind of offer an explanation. If this is how human beings learn naturally, and this is how we just naturally absorb information and discover our world and understand our world, why is our culture not used to it? Why is our culture not already learning this way? Because I do encounter resistance when I talk about this, sometimes with the audience or sometimes with others who will say, well, I don't like the trivium, or I think it's too rigorous of an approach to learning, and I think it's an unnatural approach to learning, or it requires too much work or effort of the student, and it's not for me. And I wonder why there's so much resistance to learning this way or to understanding the trivium when it really, like we were saying before, like I was trying to make the point, this is not a packaged curriculum that, you know, we're trying to sell, or in this is really a recognition of the natural way that a human being learns. So if it is, which it is, why do you think our culture has such a difficult time accepting it? Why haven't we been learning in this way? Like, schools don't really use this. Is it a result of our conditioning? Has it actually been conditioned out of us as a culture?
Well, I can speak for the last, say, 100, 120, 150 years, and a number of writers have addressed this, particularly John Taylor Gatto, who was a middle school teacher for most of his career, and has since written several books on it, relating to the Prussian system of education. And I can't really call it education. It's really a system of domestication. And what is the motive of mankind to keep his own at a lower level than himself? There are those who have come to this understanding and decide for their own advantage to keep the masses of humanity at a lower level. Now, at one time, I can see that this would be a natural situation in which these observations were passed among a very few people who understood, who came to an understanding. And then as time went on, it seemed like they wanted to hold their advantage. And I can't speak to intent. Intent is one of those areas that are very difficult to come to. But our education in America explicitly, I know this is the situation in Europe as well, but as civilization has traveled from the center of where civilization started in Asia and has moved westward over the last several thousand years, 6,000 years or so, there is this cadre of people, elitists, who want to have servants. And rather than have you develop naturally, they found ways of curtailing your ability to think and resort to authority. And that's really where all of our difficulties as individuals come from, is that we are encouraged to look at authorities at whatever level, to look up to some other person to tell you what it is, how things work. And as long as you continue to look for authority rather than thinking for yourself, you can be guided along a path, a predetermined path. And that's a very sweeping question to take into account. And it requires that people open their mind to it. And it's easy for me to say, open your mind, but it's very difficult for an individual to in fact open his mind. And that brings us back to these three methods of learning how to learn. Because by practicing them, by first internalizing them and then practicing them in life, your mind is opened. So to try to explain in a very condensed form why this is the situation requires that people have an open mind. And some people, one of the reasons I got in touch with you is you seem to express that as an adult, that you have an open mind and that you can take these concepts and put them into a modern, updated form. As I say, the trivium really goes back to the description of this. I call it a method because that's the way it's communicated, but it's really an observation as to how our mind and our brain work. And every few centuries, it has to be updated. Like the last time it was updated was around the time in Europe of St. Thomas Aquinas and his teacher, Albertus Magnus, who brought the teachings of Aristotle, which were said to be lost from the burning of the Library of Alexandria in Egypt 1,000 years earlier.
Yeah, it's about time for an update then.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Because one of the books that I recommend is written by a 20th century Catholic nun, and it's titled The Trivium by Sister Miriam Joseph. Her last name was Raw. But it's a very dense read because it's essentially Latinized English.
Mm-hmm.
So all these terms that she uses, categorematical, syncategorematical, extension of a term, intention of a term, all these have English synonyms that and are much more easily followed by people who don't necessarily know Latin. And that's where we have to go with this. And again, all you will be doing, as she did, or as Thomas Aquinas did, or in fact as Aristotle did, was to put this observation, this description of an observation, into English so that people can follow it. I understand that it's very difficult for adults with life experience to ingest this. When it's presented to you all at once, it seems very difficult. Yet when you give this to children, when you give them general grammar between age 6 and 11, and then just let them go toward their interest and use their parroting mind, they love to parrot, they love to take in data. If you can encourage language, different languages, this is the time the storehouse works. That's what they develop. This is just the way the mammal, who is raised by his family, has an extended childhood. And childhood, I'm saying, is up to the time of puberty, up to around age 11 or 12. And then the autonomous individual, the autonomous mammal, comes into being. And this is where the dialectic process, the question and answer period, comes in. And logic is just the way to phrase your questions so that you can get an answer, so that you can find out how the world around you works. And as it's been said from ancient time, to know yourself, because knowing your own mind, your own brain, is reflective of your surroundings.
What I hope to do, and what I know that we're going to do through this series that we're offering, is to really go through the stages, beginning with understanding where to begin with the trivium from an adult's perspective, so that they can begin to incorporate that into their household, and then go through specifically the stages of grammar, logic, rhetoric, and then into the quadrivium. So we have a lot to talk about, and we have a lot to discuss. I'm glad, though, that we're able to lay the groundwork. And I hope that the listeners are really understanding and appreciating that we're laying the groundwork and the basic understanding that the whole idea of learning without school and home educating is to be able to have the freedom to learn how to learn and to grow into the learners and the perpetual students that we want to be and to offer a more organic learning experience to our children. But to be able to really offer that organic learning experience, we have to be willing to, as Jean was saying, and I've always said also, really open our mind, and we have to get over our own arrogance and our own conceptions and misconceptions about how learning happens and what is really taking place in the human brain, and be able to open ourselves up to this. Now, I'm completely passionate about this, and I'm dedicated to it, and I hope to be able to spend the next several years of my life really delivering this information to you and really exploring this and really getting into this. And I feel so blessed all the time to be able to have this opportunity to do this in the way that I do it. So I just want to reiterate that and really bring it home. And, you know, if you're listening, really let this resonate with you. This is a very not, this is the way that we learn. This is the way that the human brain develops. And it's important that we return to this. The reason why we don't recognize it as natural is on purpose. It's a condition of indoctrination. It's a symptom of having been indoctrinated. And in order for us to really be free, it's important that we're able to open up our mind and say, what is this? Let me explore this. And it's important that you as a parent explore it first and understand it so that you can incorporate it with your children. Once you do that, you'll find that your children, with your children, it doesn't seem like a method or a system. It almost happens very naturally, and you as the parent will guide it along and encourage the right things at the right times. But they'll pick it up much more quickly than you have, because this is the natural way that the human brain learns. So on that note, let's bring it back to the beginning, and we're going to cover grammar in another episode, and we're going to cover logic and rhetoric and so on into the quadrivium. But let's begin with just the basic understanding. The parents out there, you're listening and you're saying, okay, I want to understand this. I want to open my mind more to this. Where do I begin? And that's when you started talking, Jean, about the methods of cognition. So I think that's a really great place for adults out there to start to really get into the meat of trivium and the concept and what it is. So let's begin there again. And what are we talking about when we talk about the three methods of cognition, and why is that important to the rest of the understanding of the trivium?
Well, you just stated it's important for adults with life experience to come to know this, because as you mentioned, if you just give these subjects, as I was given these subjects by two individuals. My mother taught me grammar, and I had a mentor, an individual, who presented logic and rhetoric to me from the age of 13, and I was already going to university in the same town there, age 20. So I had a number of years to be tutored in these methods and techniques. But you give these to children, and they don't use analysis. They don't try to figure out what it is. It just reiterates. It just makes explicit the way that they look at things, and they can put names to it. And the focus of what we're trying to achieve was stated by Aristotle, that a well-educated mind is one that can consider virtually anything without necessarily or blindly accepting it. And that is essentially the definition of an open mind, is that that your mind can actually go there. Most adults today, because of our conditioning, cannot allow their mind to go there. The only thing better than having actual knowledge is thinking that you have actual knowledge, is being under the illusion that you know it all. So that is the opium. Unlike what Marx says, that religion was the opium of the masses, it's actually the idea that you think you know something, that you will not consider another subject, that if you do consider it, you are obligated to necessarily or blindly accept it. So this goes back to your earlier question as to why is it that this has occurred through the ages. And you used a word that I thought was very appropriate when you said that we tend toward arrogance. And that is part of the human makeup, is this idea that we are arrogant. And some of us are more arrogant and have a little bit more knowledge than others of us, and we try to domesticate others to our way of thinking without them being free. That you use the word freedom. You are free from authority when you learn how to learn, and you are free to do something. You are free to explore the world on your own terms, on your own human terms. So once you learn how to learn, you learn how to think for yourself. And what is thinking? What are the ways that thinking or cognition have come about? And again, this is for parents to start to grasp this, because children don't necessarily have to have this explained to them.
Well, just to clarify that, their children are starting basically with a blank slate. There has been no previous attempt to try to domesticate them already. That's assuming that they haven't been through any schooling already. But let's assume that we're talking about a child that has not been through any conditioning or schooling or indoctrination, and they're pretty much starting with a blank slate. Parents, on the other hand, many of us have already been through this process and have been affected by it in some way, and we have this little bit of arrogance and this inability to consider without embracing and we've been a little bit domesticated. Some of us are a little bit better off than others because we're a little bit more open. I'd like to think that, you know, I'm open to learning more, and a lot of us are, and a lot of my listeners are. That's what makes the Unplugged Mom audience so valuable, is that we are a little bit more open. But it's important, we're not blank slates like children are. So we almost have to take it a step back further before we can begin with the children. And that's pretty much why we're beginning at this point with adults and not necessarily with children, because they don't need to start at this particular point.
No, the three conditions of cognition don't need to be explained. What we're really trying to get parents to understand is that by exercising the brain through the trivium, which has been known through time immemorial to improve thinking. And the reason it improves thinking is it creates more pathways in the brains. The neurons start to connect to one another. One neuron can connect to as many as 10,000 other neurons in the brain. And each one of those expresses a point of knowledge. But if you start introducing children to these concepts, it's just a natural flow. Especially these three subjects will grow the brain, will get them to understand the progression of learning and the progression of thinking. But for adults to come to an appreciation of the idea that this is exercise for the brain, that this is exercise for learning and thinking, we'll start with the idea of what life is, as I say, the spirit, that there is this respiration that living beings take in. They take in a gas, either carbon dioxide, and emit oxygen, as do plants. And symbiotically, animals have come to the point where they ingest oxygen and exhaust carbon dioxide. So it's a very symbiotic system we've set up with among living beings here on this planet. Mm-hmm. And so the first condition of cognition, of knowing your surrounding, is simple stimulus and response. There's a stimulus, the living being responds to it. There's no memory of this. And this is really, if a living entity actually just has the stimulus response, it's really a pre-consciousness ability. Now, the next stage up would be the perceptual level of knowing the surrounding, and this goes beyond stimulus response and includes memory. In other words, a stimulus of a plant would be as the sun rises in the east and goes across the sky to the west, a lot of flowering plants will follow the sun during the day. The stimulus is the sunlight, the response is the face of the flower following that path of the sun. Now, with our five senses, most animals' basic, what I would call basic advanced animals, which are reptiles, they have four senses. They don't have the sense of smell, but there's memory involved now. Now there's a stimulus. There's a discrete beam of light. And then there's a second discrete beam of light, third, fourth, so on. At some point, the eye has developed to follow motion, for example. And these are discrete levels of stimulus response. A memory is formed of it, and motion becomes part of the time and the space of that sense, and so forth for auditory, olfactory, and touch. So this is the perceptual level, and basic learning can come into this idea of perceptual. It's trial and error, but there's no real understanding present. The next level up is what the mammals and the higher so-called higher animals have developed, which includes an additional amount of memory, which is taking a number of percepts and putting them together, light, sound, putting that memory into the brain and starting to model, in other words, make predictions of what will happen in the future from what has happened in the past. And this is what children do. This is what childhood is all about.
And they do this very naturally.
It's very natural. And, yeah. And no one has found a way to effectively stop this process.
Or suppress it.
Or suppress it, yeah. It's been tried in ancient times with nutrition, was to take a newborn and try to give it less than its perceived natural amount of nutrition so that it would essentially grow up to be an automaton.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this idea of criticality, that we reach a critical point. Evidently, the human brain at just a short time after birth cannot be starved of oxygen. The brain will naturally, if nutrition is low, the brain will take most of the fuel to keep itself going. Other parts of the body may wither, but the brain seems to want to continue,
right?
Because it has a critical number of these neurons. This is my own hypothesis, so I don't know that this can be taken up elsewhere. I may have run across it at some point.
Well, it
but
sounds
this idea
like
the
natural instinct to survive.
Yeah.
There's a natural instinct to survive that is wired into us, that we're born with. It's just part of who we are as part of nature. Everything in nature has a natural instinct for survival. And then there's also the natural human instinct, which I think may be exclusive to human beings, to be free. And I think that's why children are perpetually curious, and that aspect of them, that characteristic, as much as it's been tried, really cannot be suppressed, because we have a natural instinct to survive, and we also have, we combine that with our natural instinct to be free.
Well, survival. How do we survive? We survive by modifying our environment. We don't have particular strength or vicious claws or ways of naturally hiding ourselves in our environment. Our camouflage isn't all that great.
Mm-hmm.
So what do? We use our intellect, this idea of using this critical number of brain cells to modify our environment so that we can survive. And it is, of course, a survival instinct. And it is a true instinct. It's not something that can be developed, like the trivium, which takes your instinct and starts to develop it. And in turn, many people, when you start talking about the trivium, especially the subject of logic, think that this is exclusive of instinct. What the trivium does is it actually improves your instinct. It's a spiral path. It's not an either-or situation. You're either intellectual, dryly intellectual, as I've heard it described, or you are intuitive. you build your intellect, which increases your intuitive sense. Your intuitive sense now directs your attention to something else that you would not have noticed had you remained at your former level of intuitiveness, and so on and so forth. So what the trivium is not an either-or situation. It's an also-and. It's not that you already know everything. Here is a tool by which, and I use that advisedly, that word tool, because that makes it sound like an artifice, which it has become, but it's based on natural law. And the natural law is that which we observe. And this is the way our mind was meant to be put together. Now, I went through government school. I went through public school. But I was taught this, as an aside, independently. And what I found is that parents can do this. They can teach a very condensed form of grammar to their children, and their children will start to become more curious through this natural ability to put one thing after the other in a logical sequence. And then when they get to puberty, they can start asking the proper questions of that data and build more data from what they are exposed to. This is a snowball effect. This is what this does. It gets you to be free to learn more. It gives you freedom from authority.
And it also provides, or it helps the child discover the tools to continue to learn more.
Well, these are the tools to continue to learn more. This is the progression.
Right.
You bring in data. You understand it by eliminating contradictions. And then you express it to yourself, to someone else, and refine. Next. See, now you can go on to the next subject. You can either take in more variety of information, or you can refine a subject. There's freedom again. You keep running into this idea of freedom. You are now free to learn this more minutely, or to develop it, or you are free to go on to something else that interests you, and you can make the connection with the knowledge of the subject that you previously mastered with this new one. And what does this do? It builds memory. And it builds memory without your actually being concentrated on memorizing. It's a mind map. It is the mind map. It's within your own skull where this mind map is developing. So this is the conceptual level. This is what humans, rational beings, and that description of the essence of humanity, that we are the rational being, that we are the ones who see and use ratios in our environment. Now, there are other animals that communicate in one way or the other, and it's been said that our language is the essence of the human. But language actually derives from being able to see the pattern of ratios. And that's what intelligence is. Intelligence is actually seeing these patterns. And all that the trivium does is gets you to refine your ability to see and use patterns. And more of them. And communicate more and more. The snowball effect again. Now, the trivium, I must say again, is a Latin word. I didn't discover the term until I was in my mid-30s. I was in New Zealand, and my wife is a mystery fan, and she knew of this mystery writer, Dorothy L. Sayers, who was a contemporary of Agatha Christie, who everyone knows about.
Sure.
But we were watching. Being in New Zealand, we got a lot of British television, and we were watching some dramatizations of Lord Peter Wimsey, which is a character that Dorothy Sayers developed in her series of mysteries. And I went to the library, and one of the cities that are in New Zealand and asked for a little bit of background on Dorothy Sayers. And I was introduced to this essay, The Lost Tools of Learning by Dorothy Sayers. And that's where I came across the term trivium. I did not know what trivium was. To me, the way it was explained to me, it was the first three subjects of the seven liberal arts. My mentor presented it as the art and science of the mind, the trivium, and the quadrivium as the art and science of physical matter. So that's what I knew them as.
I think that's a wonderful description. Do you agree that that seems like a very accurate description of trivium and quadrivium?
Well, it seemed natural to me. As I say, I was given these concepts at the proper time. It was extremely natural. But when I read Dorothy Sayers' essay and that term was used, I immediately knew that it referred to the scholastics, the descendants, the apostles of St. Thomas Aquinas, who reintroduced Aristotelian thinking to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went on to that same day, I just, because I knew the term, I looked up the trivium in the card catalog and came across Miriam Joseph's book on the trivium and started to read it. And as I say, if you don't know Latin or if you don't know the scholastic terminology, it's almost like reading a foreign language to read her book. She has a tremendously lucid description of general grammar in the first three chapters of that book. But once you leave that, it's very difficult to read her book linearly. It's a great book to have as a resource to use the index to check concepts or to get the scholastic name of the concept. But you can learn all this without having this term trivium or quadrivium in your face. And I've noticed that as the trivium has become more popularized, it's almost like religiosity has come to be associated with this term trivium, that it is an authority, an authoritative way of prescribing the way you learn and think. And when in fact, it is a description, not a prescription of how we would naturally act. It's just a refinement. It's just a refinement of this ability to conceptually learn.
Well, the thing of it is, I don't think we would even need a reminder or a refinement or a reiteration if we haven't strayed so far from it as a culture to begin with. It would just be how we learned and how we understood our world naturally. But because we've strayed so far from it, we actually need this. You know, I hate to even call it a method because it's, like you said, it's really not a method. It's just it's taking something that is already instinctual and developing it. It's
yes.
Developing something that already is natural. But I think the reason why we encounter such resistance is because we're so far removed from it through our conditioning. In other words, we are the victims of artificial processing already. And that's why this seems odd to mm-hmm. a lot of folks in our culture, is because we are already the victims of preconditioning and domestication and, you know, suppression and intellectual oppression. And it does take a certain amount of the being able to get over ourselves and get over our own ego and arrogance to be able to say, yeah, you know what, I think I have been conditioned and I think I have been mesmerized by my culture. And not just us personally, but generations before us, our parents as well, which is really made it very easy for us to just slip right down that road. But now to be able to wake up out of that and say, I want to be intellectually free. I want to learn more organically. I want to make sure that my children learn more organically. It does seem like we do have to make a deliberate effort to go in this direction. So what we're essentially doing is making a deliberate effort to pull away from what's artificial and adhere to what's more natural.
Well, we're trying to do this with adults, as I say, if you provide this to children. And as an adult parent, if you just present this to your children without understanding it, your children will know what to do with it.
I have already witnessed that, Gene. Honestly, I've already experienced that and witnessed that, and it both amazes me and makes me feel really good and makes me realize that I'm going to end up ultimately learning more from them than I'll be able to teach them.
Yes.
So it's a remarkable, when you open up your mind and you say, okay, I really want to be able to experience this kind of growth and this return to a organic way of thinking and processing information. And it almost, you start to, when you understand it, you almost instinctively begin to apply it with your children, and they just adapt to it so quickly. It's so natural for them because they're just there already, mm-hmm. you know? So it's that definitely is true.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's continue here with our introduction for adults. I suppose we should call it. We've covered briefly the three types of cognition.
Mm-hmm.
Among living beings on this planet. Let's go to the way we have developed over time, and this was a sequential development. We started with trying to understand phenomena and entities around us, and it was discovered that we can understand things if we compare phenomena with people, if we make up people stories. And we'll have something like, say, an earthquake. Well, this occasionally happens, periodically, comes about without a warning, and it's a very important event in life. It grabs our attention, these earthquakes. So how do we try to understand? So we make up a people story about it, that possibly there is a being that's very much like we are. A god being, we'll call it Neptune, the god of the sea, who agitates the sea, which in turn causes the island or the landmass to shake. So we attribute this natural phenomena to this imaginary godlike anthropomorphic being called Neptune, and that's passed down through the ages as a narrative story, and it's the narrative is built upon and so on and so forth, and after a while, in order to keep it in mind, we build up an institution around this type of thinking, and in order to pass it on, our brain has a center in it, the center for prosody, it's called, and it takes spoken sound. It's the musicality of language. It's tempo and meter, and takes in rhyme and these various things that stimulate our memory, and we can pass it down to our progeny. So these people stories of natural phenomena passed down, and we started as one tradition morphed into another tradition. There were enough differences that the two traditions could be called separate or were seen as separate, the one person's religion became the other person's mythology.
Mm-hmm.
So as we passed forward in time and we modified these traditions, our religion was deemed as being authoritative or true, and the origin of our tradition was now seen as that other man's mythology. So religion is current, mythology is that from which it came and is not complete.
But it's really the same source.
It's really the same source, and mythology really are people stories. And that's where everything, once you come up with a people story, you're not really looking for truth. You're just looking to refine the people story, to make another mythology. And this is comforting to arrogant man, because now we know where the earthquake came from. Now, this is the illusion of knowing rather than knowing it itself.
That's I want to stop you for just one second, because I think that is tremendously important what you just said. The illusion of knowing instead of, or rather than knowing itself. That is tremendously important for us to really think about, because there is a significant difference there. And human beings have an unbelievable and remarkable ability to do this. And if we just kind of reiterate that for a second, what we do is we take something that we don't understand and we make up a story about it in order to try to understand it. And then we cling to that story and we say, well, this is it. This is how it is. And then it follows that natural progression through time as our culture develops and we want it to make more sense and agree with our culture, then it becomes religion and the prior story becomes mythology. But we still cling to this explanation and say, well, this is how it is. But there is a significant difference between knowing and just the illusion of knowing. And I think that really does trip us up as human beings, and it has a lot to do with our arrogance.
Well, I heard your interview with Paul Verge, and you mentioned it very succinctly. Our blessing is our curse, and right. Our curse is our blessing. Our blessing is this ability to try to understand, but our curse can become our narrowing viewpoint, that our made-up stories, our made-up people stories, this tool that was brought into being, which was to, this is, mythology is teaching through analogy, through making comparisons, comparing that which we don't yet understand or know to that which we do have a better grasp, a more fully understood and known situation. And so mythology is really analogical thinking. It's making comparisons of things and phenomena to people, of knowing ourselves. And we can go wrong, but let's give credit where credit is due. This is the first step in conceptual thinking, in making these comparisons. But of course we have contradictions. So I'm going to use what we in the West have been brought to understand, which is the Western tradition. The person, or really the school, and school here is used in a positive sense. School is actually relating to a school of fish, a number of fish that come together as a school, as opposed to a herd or a hive or any of those more derogatory terms, which are also used to describe gatherings of humans. But a school is simply people that have come together to consider a certain situation, not necessarily to learn and teach, but to consider. So the school of Thales, who was an ancient Greek, Thales of Miletus, was developed. And Thales, actually it was one of his descendants, but he was the first one who was said after reflection, several hundred years later, after Plato, another ancient Greek, codified the idea of philosophy, which is to study the thing itself, to study the phenomena, to study the thing, without these extraneous ideas of supernatural beings, of simplifying, to look at the thing directly rather than to compare it to something else. And Thales, now his method or his explanation was fallacious, but he was trying to look at the thing itself without including the motivations of a god being or a god being itself. And he said that the earthquake that we were using it as our example was actually, again, he already had the idea of the sea being agitated and shaking the earth. Well, he just said that the earthly sea was itself agitated by the cosmic sea. Now, the ancients saw space, or the fifth element, ether, around us as a sea. I mean, it even had the same color. This ethereal sea was blue. It was a lighter blue than the darker blue of the earthly ocean. Okay. But the cosmic sea agitated, which in turn agitated the earthly sea, which in turn shook the land and caused the earthquake. Now, again, this was fallacious, but he was eliminating the God being. He was looking at the nature of the thing itself. What is nature? So he
In other
started
words,
this.
dealing with what it actually is instead
Yes.
of trying to add all kinds of external explanations to it
Right.
and just looking at it for what it actually is.
He was actually looking to explain the nature of the thing itself. And so this opened up this idea. We're told that this started in Greece, we here in the West, but it was really all these ideas came from the cradle of civilization in Asia. But it's easy for us to follow because these are our traditions. And so he started this idea of looking at the thing itself to try to explain the nature of the thing itself rather than comparisons. Use comparisons as far as they go, and then try to get nature's explanations. Try to draw out nature's explanation. And so this was the idea of philosophy, the love of wisdom. And one of his successors, one of Thales' successors, was Pythagoras, and he was initiated in some of the ancient mystery schools in the Aegean and Mediterranean and down in Egypt and finally over to India, and he came back and started his own philosophical school, which was to look at the thing itself. Now he still had the remnants of religiosity. His mysteries were the Orphic religions. And this was the religion of number, really the beginnings of the quadrivium, how number itself, how the universe was made, was shaped by number. And but he still was looking at the thing itself. He was codifying this. And we move forward about a couple of centuries. 300 years, perhaps. I've forgotten my exact history, but Plato came along and codified what philosophy was. And it's the idea of what is, which has come down to us as the one of the four branches of philosophy is called metaphysics, and that's just the study of what is in itself. This is really what Thales was trying to get at. And then the second branch of philosophy is epistemology, or how our mind processes that which is, how we come to understand it. But they're intricately related. Metaphysics, the study of what is, and the way our mind processes what is, leads us to how do we act advantageously in life. And this is the third branch of philosophy. And it was really ethical philosophy. And this is how do, now that we know or have an idea of what is, we know how we came to use our mind as to coming to that conclusion, how we form an argument. Now, how do we advantageously act ourselves and with our environment and with our neighbors? And this is ethics. And then the final branch he called aesthetics, which was how do you communicate all of these abstract ideas? And you communicate them through, at that time, the seven fine arts, they were called, which is fine painting, sculpture, architecture, drama, music, and dance, and poetry or literature. Those are the seven fine arts. This is how we communicate what is, how we know what is, and how we act
And
advantageously.
this triangle, so to speak, okay, what is and understanding what is and then communicating what is really the basis of the trivium, which is grammar, which is discovery, and then logic, which is understanding, and rhetoric, which is communication.
Well, it's actually a freer form of that because the trivium itself actually belongs in epistemology. How do we know what is? How do we know? We look, we sense, we perceive. Then we take the contradictions in our own mind out of what we perceive, because that's the way the human mind works. It will include contradictions. So you have to focus on taking the contradictions out. And then you explain it or teach, as you put it, to become the master, to know what is. And this is all epistemology in philosophy. Philosophy is a broader subject. And see, the trivium was as far as I can see, it was developed first. It was the narrow focus. And then philosophy comes along and tries to explain more than just the workings of the human mind. But now we're talking about the workings of the universe, or the nature of the working of the universe, not the mythology, not the analog of the nature, but the nature itself. And this is philosophy. And then we come forward to what truly is a method. And when we get to Galileo, he actually demonstrated it. But our focus is really going to be Aristotle, because Aristotle came up with the idea of the rules of science. He also came up with the idea of the rules of logic and of rhetoric, as expressed to us in the Western tradition. But science to him was that which was demonstrated. Now, in ancient Greece, they took intellect to the nth degree. Aristotle is the personification of aristocrat, of the idea of aristocrat. And so he was concerned with those who were the educated group of people, as opposed to the slave population, who were denied education. But Aristotle said that if you demonstrate something, and he developed logic as deductive logic, that you manipulate the written word or the written explanation to the point where it is demonstrated that it can only be this way. If you demonstrate a deductive argument to be valid, to be true, you will have followed a valid progression.
Okay.
And this is where logic really becomes intricate. But by the time you're finished, it will have been demonstrated to be true. But his entire focus was on the mind, that the mind can demonstrate this deduction. So these were the beginnings of the rules of science. And he made all kinds of observations of what we now call the physical sciences, the life sciences, and the earth sciences. And he was considered the father of zoology, because he started a different type of way of categorizing life, animal life. And he looked at various traits that various species had. And we still use his method for the life sciences, for putting these together. They've been refined over the years. But he made a lot of or statements about what is, scientifically. Like, he said that women had fewer teeth than men. Now, he didn't bother to look. See, he just deduced women are smaller than men, so they must have fewer teeth. He didn't bother to count. Or he said that heavy objects fall faster than light objects. He didn't bother to test it.
Right.
So you move forward to the time of Galileo, and Galileo sets up some ramps, and he takes some rolling balls, one that's heavier than the other, and he finds that, in fact, they come to the end of the ramp at the same time. Then he goes up to the Tower of Pisa, and he drops them. They hit the ground the same time. So what he's now doing is physically demonstrating. And this is scientific demonstration. Now, science has become... The word for science has become corrupted in our time. I don't know. So that we don't look for things for ourselves. Galileo, who went to Rome, he was quite well connected with the Roman Catholic Church at that time, and asked them to look through his telescope, to look at the heavens, to look at the... He had discovered satellites around Jupiter. And all you have to do is look through this, and you'll see them. And the churchman said that he was bewitched. You cannot trust your eyes, or you cannot trust instrumentality. And so there was quite a protracted investigation into his life and his teachings. And the whole idea was that now this man has challenged authority. the world works as we, the churchmen, say it works. Not only does the world work like this, but the other dimensions of space and time work as we say it is. Because if we dare look through that tube or roll those balls down that ramp,
we might find out the truth.
Well, you and I can do it. We don't have to look to the authority of the churchmen to tell us, you see.
It goes back to what you said before. As long as you continue to look to an authority.
Then
remain controlled by that authority.
Right.
And this is, it's important for us to break free of that and learn to think on our own and challenge things and question things. And this is very important.
You give this to children and they're not rebellious about this.
They haven't already been conditioned to rely on an authority.
Right.
They're free naturally.
Right.
They're already there.
Another person that you interviewed, Jarrett Sanchez, has picked up these ideas very succinctly over the last couple of years. And in your interview, you see how serene he speaks. He speaks in a very serene tone. He's very measured. And the reason he's measured is he thinks before he speaks. And he thinks in this natural progression. And this is what everyone who is presented with these concepts, who have the implicit knowledge made explicit, become.
Mm-hmm.
They are free to think for themselves.
You know, Gene, that's it right there. That's it right there, is the freedom to think for ourselves. And it sounds like such a simple statement and something that people can easily hear and then just keep walking and say, okay, yeah, it sounds beautiful, and then just go on with their lives. But I really would encourage everyone listening to really meditate on that a minute. The freedom to think for yourself. We don't really have that freedom in the way that we think we do. What we are living in now is the illusion of knowing, but we don't really know. And I think the most important idea that we can absorb right now or really resonate ourselves on is the fact that all we really know is that we don't know anything at all. And I think that's important in the pursuit of knowledge, because it allows us to get over our arrogance and to really pursue understanding and knowing our world. Now, you might be thinking, why is this important? Why is it important that I sharpen myself intellectually? Why is it important that I understand the concept of the trivium and learn how to learn? Why is it important that I bestow that upon my children? And you know what? I'm going to go back and correct myself, because bestow is really the wrong word. All you're really doing is encouraging your children to move in that direction, because again, they're already there. They haven't been oppressed yet. They haven't been conditioned yet. They haven't been domesticated yet. We have. So it's important that we break free in order to encourage our children to remain free, so to speak. But you might be saying, why is this important? It sounds confusing. Why is it important that I understand it? And it comes down to freedom. To freedom. Because as long as we enslave ourselves to an authority and keep looking to an authority to tell us what to do, then we remain intellectually enslaved. And we're intellectually enslaved, then we're enslaved. And it really does come down to breaking free of the control. And the control that, Gene, you were talking about several minutes ago in this conversation today, it's important to break free of that, because we're not meant to be enslaved. And we really are. We really are as a culture. And it really does take a return to this natural and organic progression of learning. And we could use Galileo as a perfect example of that kind of intellectual enslavement, because it keeps you submissive to an authority. And most of us know what ultimately happened to Galileo and his discoveries. And it wasn't until hundreds of years later that we were able to finally say, okay, well, maybe Galileo was right. And that's always something that I talk about with my kids, because that's important. Unfortunately, we're running out of time for this particular episode, but I want to remind everyone that we are moving ahead into the trivium itself, and we're going to be talking about how to understand the trivium so that we can encourage our kids in that direction. And we did cover grammar, So we're going to be releasing that at the same time as this. You'll be able to find grammar right alongside this podcast. The link will be right there, available on the website. And in the future, we're going to be covering logic and then rhetoric and so on, because Jean has been good enough to agree to cover that with us and help us learn and explore together. And on that note, thank you so much for joining us today, Jean. And can you just give us a real quick idea of what we're going to be discovering when we talk about the grammar stage?
We're essentially going to discover how to differentiate reality from unreality. And I'll leave you with that somewhat cryptic description. But that's essentially what grammar discerns for us. The study and practice of grammar gets us to understand the difference between reality, objective reality, and unreality, subjective unreality.
Excellent. Excellent. I hope that everyone checks that out. I know that I'm looking forward to doing the rest of these interviews because I'm learning so much, and I hope that you, the audience, the listeners, are getting just as much out of this as I am, because I think this is extremely important, and I know that many of you are in agreement with that, and you're finding this extremely important too. Jean, I'm so grateful to you for taking the time to share all of this with us and share your wisdom and your knowledge and your understanding with us, and to continue to learn and grow and progress with humanity. I think you're a fantastic resource, and I'm honored. I'm honored to interview you.
Well, thank you for those kind words. And I would like to say that I want to reiterate that what we're doing is really just providing an introduction. These studies have to be taken up by the individual himself. And when he internalizes it, it's his accomplishment. It's his achievement. It doesn't come from me or from you or from the people in the past. It is the realization of the individual who internalizes these concepts and makes this the default method of his own thinking and learning. So I look forward to each of us coming to these realizations, to actualize our natural humanity. It's that simple.
Well, understanding can never really be forced on anyone. It can only be introduced, and then it's up to us.
That's right.
Excellent. Excellent. Again, thank you very much, Jean, and I look forward to our next conversation.
As do I. Thank you, Lorette.
Okay, folks, that was Jean O'Denning, Introduction to More Trivium. Please make sure that you stay tuned and listen in for the upcoming episodes, where we will continue to explore the trivium in this exclusive Unplugged Mom series. Thank you so much for listening. This is Laura Lynn, the Unplugged Mom, saying bye-bye.